The next one.
Tomorrow,
Dinu saiki pici susi metu tamari rune shiri jemu ne sani jemu me dembu ayi doku yanam da kino shepar so edama guru re nam do ayame sanga je je do jo je jo nam shanju bandu dane shusi na ye je ye je be sanam je do la pe je sanje bu par so sanga je je do jo je jo nam ayame do
Ra 마게 생기 타지 때도 도저 어느매 바야다고 저기 생기 공부를 못 깨는지 더 시작을 계속 더 세위 채도 근데 교회를 뭐지 세냐 배 그런 사람이 생기 세 세배고 세머게
Let me remind all of ourselves to cultivate the altruistic motivation seeking complete enlightenment for the sake of liberating infinite, kind, mother-sensing beings. With that kind of bodhicitta motivation, we should all participate in this teaching.
That Lauren, the Nandu Lakyan Tini, that Shai Pamukhava Kani, Nima Nikhtav Dunja Sungurin Tina Yuris, that Nandu Nisimba Dele Yuris,
I have been given this Lamrim teaching on the stages of path enlightenment based on a particular Lamrim text called Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand, in Tibetan called Lamrim Namdul Lakchang. And the great Tibetan master, Gyatso Pabongpa Dorjechang, he taught this for 21 days. And so we have been.
Twenty-one weeks.
And we have been dealing with.
23.
So it has been teaching for 23 weeks, and we have been dealing with the third day Lamrim teaching.
That is in Italy, trying to get you, but I was in Alemia, Duxin, Dakasim, Chinsai, to be my practice for me.
I just assume that you have not forgotten the points we have covered thus far, but anyway, I'm going to do a quick review of the points. There are four major outlines. And the first major outline is in order to integrate the authenticity of the teaching, we deal with the preeminent qualities of the authors. As we pay attention to this particular outline, it's really important because in order to show the authenticity or the validity of the teaching, we deal with the qualifications, if you will, we call preeminent qualities of authors
of Lamrim.
As I mentioned already this to you before, that if we are to spend a lot of time on the qualifications or the preeminent qualities of the authors, then we have to start from Shakyamuni Buddha, who is our founding teacher, and we have to deal with his principal deeds of Buddha and so on. So we have to go through all of that. So if we do deal with this particular point extensively, the qualifications, the preeminent qualities of the authors of the teaching, then we start with Shakyamuni Buddha, we have to go through his 12 principal deeds, and then we have to deal with qualifications or the preeminent qualities of the extensive lineage masters, or the lineage masters of the extensive path, and which basically begins with Shakyamuni Buddha, and then to the Maitreya, then from Maitreya to the Asanga, and so on. So we have to deal with the preeminent qualities of each of these great masters of our lineages. So like we deal with this extensive aspect or the dimension of the Buddha's teaching, which begins with Shakyamuni Buddha, then comes to the Maitreya, then to the Asanga, then to other successive masters, all the way to our root guru. And then, of course, we have to deal with the qualifications or the preeminent qualities of the lineage masters of the profound dimension of Buddha's teaching or the profound path, and which, of course, begins with Shakyamuni Buddha, and then Manjushri, Arya Nagarjuna, and down through many other great masters, including the Vidya Kukila, and so on. So all these lineage masters of the profound path, their qualities need to be
presented.
So we could talk about these different aspects of the dimensions of Buddha's teaching. There is the extensive aspect of the dimension, there is the profound aspect of the dimension of Buddha's teaching. But we also need to keep in our mind that in terms of practice, we need to integrate these two dimensions of the Buddha's teaching, the extensive aspect and the profound aspect, into the together. And these lineages, as a matter of fact, have been integrated together. And I already talked about that before.
So,
remember that we talked about how at what point of time in the lifetime of which particular guru or the lama that these two lineages have been integrated or brought together. You know, these two lineages have met, if you will, or intersected with each other. So if I need to help to refresh your memory, then as I said, during the time of great Adisha, or Dipankar Shrijan Adisha, these two lineages were brought together, were integrated or combined together.
So
So if we were to deal with the first major outline, which is in order to authenticate or to show the authenticity of the teaching, we talk about the preeminent qualities of the authors, then we really have to talk extensively about the preeminent qualities of the Buddha and other lineage masters, as I mentioned earlier. Of course, usually we don't have time to do that. So during the time of Lamrim teaching, such as teaching on the great Lamrim, great exposition of the stages of path to enlightenment, what the gurus do is they often really, focus on some of the gurus, particularly great Atisha, because he was the original, if you will, author of the Lamrim treatise or the Lamrim text.
That you can
When we say that great Atisha was the original author of the Lamrim, what we meant is it was great Atisha who wrote the first, what we call the fundamental Lamrim text called the Lamb of Path to Enlightenment or Bodhiprabha or Lamrim in Tibetan. So we wonder, like, how did really Atisha come up with the first Lamrim text? Of course, I mean, he relied very heavily on the ideas or the teachings of the Shakyamuni Buddha. Whatever Buddha taught in the 84,000 discourses, Atisha, as it brought the essence, the essential principles of all the Buddha's teaching together, and together in his Lamrim, which is the Lamb of Path to Enlightenment.
That Lamrim, the Lamrim Jitzawa Tang, and the Dalai Lama Kai Gondri, Tanichi Chalyo.
So Bodhiprata Pradipam, or the Lamrim, the Lamb of Path, it can be considered as a text which summarizes the essence of Buddha's teachings. And it's also, we can see, as it is the original Lamrim text, and it is in that sense also a commentary on Buddha's teaching. So now, what is the subject matter or the content of the Lamb of the Path, or Atisha's Lamrim, you ask? What is its subject matter? Its subject matter deals with what we call the stages of the paths followed by the three types of spiritual beings or practitioners. We talk about initial level practitioner or initial level being and their practice. We talk about the intermediate level practitioner and their practice. We talk about the advanced level practitioner or being and their practice. But these three levels of practice should not be seen as three completely separate, unrelated practices. As a matter of fact, we can conceptualize that all these three types of practice are related to and can be done by an individual practitioner. So that means if an individual practitioner wants to progress on the path and stages to enlightenment, what he or she should do, if we ask that question, then the Lamrim, you know, presents the complete structure of the path that an individual practitioner can cultivate and follow all the way from the starting point all the way to the end point, which is enlightenment. So when we present Buddha's teaching as very extensively, we talk about 84,000 discourses. Now that's a big number, you know. And but if you really look at the very essence of all these 84,000 discourses, what is that all about? What it's really all about is how an individual practitioner from the level of an ordinary being, right, can progress on the path all the way to the complete enlightened state, which is the ultimate spiritual destination or the goal. Okay? So Buddha's all teachings are to do with that. But then what Lamrim does is, Lamrim is more like a practice guide. You know, it kind of brings all the essence of Buddha's teachings and put it in a complete structure, like a complete structure of the path, where should we begin the path, and how can we progress on the path and stages all the way to enlightened state. So in that sense, Lamrim is a great practice guide.
She was in Jalam Jerumba, and he even told me, and he did this. She wrote it at them because of Sue, you mutum Sue, Yamaris, say Yum, you mutum Yum, Maris. Togo.
As Jerumuche or Majama Sangaba states very beautifully and profoundly in the Lamrim, and Geshe-la quoted the lines from his memory, he says that the Lamrim, it presents the practices of the three types of practitioner. So, you know, and so intelligent people are really captivated by the Lamrim teachings. And he said, how can there be an intelligent person who is really not attracted by, not inspired by, not captivated by the Lamrim teaching?
So that can be said. So the question he would do those. Just like you know, that thing and the Lamrim the knowledge. And he's that is the conversation of church Pumbo, that can lead to soon and then to come to you. What is going to that? Dune, you know, the Yabat Kana.
And as Geshe-la quoted lines from his memory, Lama Tsongkhapa tells us that Lamrim really captures the essence of all the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha.
That's on the top and this on the Tanda the Tambo then and Chiwa given on any greater Tambo on any greater. And Zababi Chewa, Church Kung, Zababi Chewa Kigwaker, and Church Kung Kigwurz. Church Kung Mayabo Mahina, and Church Namda immediately, and they take two mothers. So then Zababi Chewa Kitchenbury.
So, of the four major outlines or the key points under which Lamrim is presented, the first one is we said, in order to integrate the authenticity of the teaching, the author's qualities are presented. You know, so if we say, why do we really have to deal with the qualifications or the qualities of the authors of Lamrim? Because we really, in order to understand whether the teaching we are receiving is a valid teaching, is an authentic teaching, you know, then we really need to know about the qualifications of the authors of the teaching.
So it is
in that context, I just want to remind you that we have dealt with, to a good extent, the qualifications or the qualities of a great Adisha. So looking at great Adisha's contributions to use the modern language, what did he do? What was his contributions to Dharma? So then we talk about Adisha's contributions to Dharma in India and Adisha's contributions to Dharma in Tibet.
That Jagal ne tebe shavan jisde pensan sanje me shavan dogi na ta pele pa nindu ke zuko zukal lala ma yishu de shenju ke pe de kule mamu chen du se duwa ta zo ngaju tengo ne.
Of course, great Adisha did amazing contributions in India for Dharma, and as far as his contributions to Tibet concerned, it all began with the invitation given to him by the Tibetan kings by the name of Palama, Yishivu, and Changzhubu. And through their invitation, Adisha came to Tibet, and that's where the story about Adisha in Tibet began.
So that Lamrim Zayate, Lamrim Zawate, Puram Zayn was.
And Adisha composed the name of path, Bodhipradapradipam, in Tibet at the request of these Tibetan kings.
Lamdren de Pul Zeni, Jagalapa Pudus and Jagal Kebatsopet, sanji meshe pese gato shimbo. Tio je ne, pel mape na, jaga nanu yu na nire ki zom nang maris. Tisani, kupe pel pepe de kira yabu shungi shi, ma gyo nang do wasi.
And after Atisha completed his Lamrim text in Tibet, he sent a copy to India to the Buddhist masters in India, and then they all looked at it and they were just amazed by this incredible work he produced in Tibet. He said, had he not been to Tibet, we would not have seen this kind of a work. So it was great that Atisha went to Tibet and now we have this great work.
Mm. So that then they said, that then they said that, well, look at you, you know, and you may reach out to look at you, you know, you know, and then they said, Kadam be, Kadam be to different sort of.
And the great Atisha spent 17 years in Tibet, and it is because of his presence in Tibet the Kadamba tradition originated. So Kadamba tradition originated with great Atisha. Then of course there were many great Kadamba masters such as the three Kadamba brothers and many others. Of course the most Now the second major outline or the key point under which Lamrim is presented is called in order to you know, cultivate respect and faith in the teaching, the qualities of the teaching or the Dharma are presented. And then the third major outline is how to teach and how to listen to the teachings which are characterized by those two preeminent qualities. In other words, the preeminent qualities of the authors of Lamrim and the preeminent qualities of the teaching itself. So how to listen and how to teach, you know, such a teaching characterized by two sets of preeminent qualities. So how to teach and how to listen? How to listen to teaching involves how we should be free of the three, metaphorically speaking, the three folds of a container, and we should cultivate six types of recognitions. So by cultivating six types of recognitions and being free of the three folds of a container or vessel, then we could really listen to
Dharma teaching.
And also teachers or those who teach must also fulfill certain qualities or qualifications. And among the qualifications, some important ones include that they should teach with pure motivation. The motivation must not be diluted in some shape or form. It should be out of pure motivation, and the teacher should have expertise in what they teach and so on. So these are the things we should really kind of bring to our mind and reflect upon. You know, if we kind of don't think about them, then slowly, slowly we will lose these key points or the major outlines. You know, so we really need to keep in touch with, if you will, these key points through reflection, through contemplation, through meditation.
dukhi ke chamba khayin dukhi tuk na ne ane rang la meba tar dukhi ta chue la me chin dukhi ane chue tam ba la meba khibin dukhi so ta zumbu de kita ke chin buji chag go bas te
if you look at say six recognitions that listeners should cultivate, I'll just kind of focus on three of them. That we should see ourselves as if we are the patients who are in need of, you know, Dharma medication, if you will. And that the Dharma or the teaching should be seen as a medication that we need. And we should see the teachers as like the doctors or the physicians, right? So, I mean, these are all really very important, recognitions that we need to adopt.
That thing told her, name,
and then another important recognition is that if we have a serious sickness, right, we just can't take medication for 1 or 2 days or a week and then we can stop it. You know, we really need to take the medication until we are cured. So there has to be kind of a sustained effort to take the medication as long as we need it. So in the same way, we have to have the attitude in the world, we call it recognition, that we are going to cultivate Dharma, or we are going to keep in touch with the Dharma in a very sustained manner, not to kind of do it, you know, some days and not other days, or, you know, randomly, you know, do it and don't do it, you know, can't do that.
So that, then the leader, then you can change the situation.
So these are all very important for us to really think about, and I'm just kind of about how to say bringing them again, so that you have an opportunity to think about them.
That the thing that none of the jungle, none of that, and the data we get, that because Mambo Kyuji, Kananda was carrying is that, that can be any behind so any.
And then we also witness many personal instruction advices from the Kadampa masters, you see, in this kind of Lamrim. When we go through the liberation in the palm of your hand, Lamrim text, we also witness many kind of personal advices or instructions coming from Kadampa masters.
That Lam Chanju Lamjaram Patasha.
Perhaps the most important thing that we should keep in our mind all the time is that what is the purpose of studying Dharma or the Lamrim in this particular case. The purpose here is so that we understand the Lamrim and we can practice it, we can put it into practice to subdue our mind. So subduing or taming our mind is the real purpose behind our study of Lamrim.
That on a random sim did Mandi the Shankarishan, that ran a nipple talk, condition shown beginning. Ran the hint that condition in the window. And then nipple talk, condition shown beginning. Ran the Sinji, ran the hint that Sinji Mandi with Wonky, McGill Lazer, Sandy in Rebut, that name the more, so Ranton Young.
So what if we don't really bother to tame our minds? So in other words, so what's the big deal, okay? You know, if I don't tame our minds, so what does it matter really? What it really does matter is when our mind is not tamed, subdued, then we find ourselves indulging in and doing negative karmic actions. Now when we do the negativities, now negativities bring negative results or outcomes. So that's why we ourselves experience what we call the negative ripening results of the bad karmas we create. You know, why do we create a bad karma or accumulate? Because our mind is not tamed, it is not subdued.
Same thing.
Let's consider this point, like whether we do something positive or negative, what really goes first is our mind. You know, we think about it, you know. First we have to think about what we're going to do, good or bad. So the mind is a forerunner of our actions. As said by Great Master, he said that mind is the forerunner of all our other actions.
That, it leads us into doing other things.
Well, we can think about all the things we do in everyday life, right? In most of the cases, I would say, first we think what we're going to do, right? Then our mind has the idea what to do or what we want to do. And then, you know, whatever the mind says, if it requires bodily movement, then we use our body, we move our body. If it requires, you know, our speech, you know, then we, you know, say something what the mind wants us to say, you know. So in most of the things we do in everyday life, our body and speech is following the orders of the mind. You know, mind tells body and speech to do something, and then they act. So how should we understand, you know, whether the mind is tamed or untamed or subdued or not, right? If we find that we're able to direct our mind into something positive, doing the positive things, that it does not go after negativities, then we could say that our mind is trained, it is tamed.
So that
When we think about mind, there are different levels. In each of our case, you know, there is what we call the positive state of mind, or virtuous state of mind. Then there is the negative state of mind, or unvirtuous state, non-virtuous state of mind. Then there is what we call neutral state of mind, meaning that which is neither positive nor negative. So each of us could experience, you know, these three states of mind, if you will. So now, of these three states of mind, when we follow either the positive mind or the negative mind, then our actions will bring positive and negative results, okay? But the neutral state of mind, that which is neither positive nor negative, it does not produce any result. It is just like, you know, burnt seeds of a grain, right? If the grain seeds are burnt, it's not going to germinate, it's not going to produce sprouts. So just like that, the neutral state of mind does not produce outcome, but the positive and negative state of mind produce outcomes. So as Dharma practitioners, what we really need to do is that we try to block out, if you will, the negative state of mind, and we try to let or cultivate positive state of mind. So that is our what we call job, if you will, you know, our responsibility. You know, we prevent the negative state of mind from arising, block it out, you know, put a stop sign there. Then we let the positive state of mind, you know, arise or cultivate it, and just put a welcome sign there. You know, that's part of our job. Now are you wondering when do we experience the neutral state of mind?
I
think we do experience that quite a bit, you know, that, you know, sometimes we find ourselves in a state of mind, we are neither thinking about positive nor about negative. It's just kind of our mind is just like, you know, it's either very distracted, you know, it is nowhere. It's just kind of there. You know, it's not thinking positive, negative. It's just somewhere, you know. Now, do you think that when we are sleeping, our mind is in a neutral state? Sleep can be positive, it can be negative, or it can be neutral. So sleep does not fall into, it does not have to be neutral. You know, it can be positive, it can be negative, or it can be neutral
state of mind.
I think maybe we should talk about this, you know, how sleep can be any of the three different types of mind. Before we fall asleep, just we are maybe thinking, right? If we think some positive thoughts, say we are cultivating faith and respect in Buddha or Dharma or Sangha, or that we are cultivating, you know, sense of compassion or love, and so by cultivating such state of mind, you know, if we fall asleep, then our sleep, you know, becomes a positive state of mind.
Yeah.
So if we cultivate such positive thinking and we fall asleep in that manner, so all this period of time we are sleeping until we wake up from sleep, the whole period of time we are sleeping, that sleep becomes a positive state of mind. On the other hand, before we fall asleep, if we think something negative thought, you know, we will think about killing someone or, you know, stealing something or cheating someone or lying to someone, any kind of negative thought, and in that manner we fall asleep, then whole period of time we are sleeping, our sleep becomes a negative state of mind. But let's say you had a long day and you worked really hard, you come back and you just basically got knocked up, right? You just didn't think about positive, negative, you're just so exhausted and tired that you're just knocked out and you fall asleep. Probably that state of mind, the sleep, is a neutral state of mind. So that's about sleeping, right? Now what about dreaming? You know, the dreaming can also be positive or negative or neutral as well. I think if I give just an example for each, then maybe that will serve the purpose
here.
Let's say that we have fallen asleep and we dream about, killing someone, killing a being or a sentient being. So this is kind of talking to the monks, you know, we in different metaphysical texts, you know, they find these things. Anyway, so you fall asleep, or we fall asleep, and in this state of dream, we dream about killing someone. And then we wake up from our sleep, but then we kind of rejoice in that, you know, great, you know, I killed a fellow, you know. And it was just that rejoicing, about that dream about killing someone, as, you know, we rejoice at the end, that dream state becomes a negative state of mind.
That thing I like,
So On the other hand, say we dream about saving somebody's life, you know, doing something good for a being or a sentient being, and then when we wake up from sleep, we just kind of still have this happiness, you know, joy in the heart. You know, we were so happy that we saved somebody's life, you know. And in that case, our dream state becomes a positive state of mind.
So that can be something I'm not done.
So in order for us to stop negativities and do the positive things, you know, we have to educate ourselves in these matters. We really have to know what does negativity mean, what are negativities that we must not do, right? If we don't know about negativities, then we there's no way to block them out. There's no way to stop doing negativities.
But nyamo de dat nyamo bat zeta ane megi le da chal gar bas dat dat la khate chan te nyamo ten khate cha gar bas zeta khate cha ji zan ne khate cha sa da ma go ne te ka de chegur bas pena dan do jin go ne so we ran do dat ha ma go ne te ko ti ye ma ro ti thug ma ro te
from a spiritual point of view, our real enemies are negativities and delusions, or deluded states of mind. But these are our real enemies, and we need to fight with them. We need to use antidotes to, you know, attack them, to fight with them, right? But if we really don't know who our enemies are, or what our enemy is, but then how can we fight, you know, start a fight? We cannot, see? So it's really important to recognize our enemies to be able to fight with them. So when the soldiers go into the battlefield, if they don't know who their enemies are, so what are they really going to, you know, do? And who are they fighting with,
you know?
So if we are in a kind of a target shooting practice or whatever, right? If we don't know where the target is, you know, I mean, we can never hit it, you know? So it will all be just, you know, indiscriminate shooting and, you know, random shooting.
So,
in order to get rid of negativities or the delusions, you know, applying antidotes to them, we really have to recognize what the negativities or delusions are. Without that kind of a recognition or understanding, there is really no way to tackle them and to get rid of them. We just simply think in a sort of a blanket, you know, way of thinking, like, you know, I know that a lot of things negativities to get rid of, you know. So I hope they all get eradicated. But that itself will not do anything. You know, if you just think that a lot of negativities that need to be got rid of and make it happen, you know, nothing's going to happen really.
Right. Why is that, Mambo? Nyebo la Mambo yabun jase.
And then we kind of feel like, you know, I think there's a lot of antidotes, zillions of antidotes, you know.
But I don't know. They know what they think.
Yeah. But I really don't know anything in particular. I know there are a lot of antidotes, you know. But then, you know, that kind of abstract notion of negativities and antidotes is not going to lead us anywhere.
So,
So our real enemies are the delusions. We need to study them. We need to, you know what they are. And then we need to find, how should I say, antidotes to counteract them.
So
as I said, you know, as I speak about these things too, I'm also, you know, communicating to myself. You know, I don't make an exception to myself that I can teach you what to do and then I don't need to do it. You know, whether we are Dhamma teachers or listeners to the teaching, I mean, we all have to recognize delusions as our real enemies and then counteract them.
Then the 강착 때 시작하려면 여러분.
자기들로. And as the great first Dalai Lama said in his spiritual songs, the poems, Shakyamuni Mountain, which can simply be translated as Snowy Mountain, I think. He says that, oh friends, you should know that the real enemy resides within you, not outside. So now I mean, we really have to really understand that and feel it, that the real enemy that we are fighting with exists within us, not outside.
딴 나란도 딱히 던다게 나고 치들 딱다 같이 내가 잡이나 딴 나란도 비냐면 도세 농다 있어
So now
Come on Lord Come on
So we really have to be careful in studying these things. And Geshe-la says, you know, okay, now if you really don't pay attention to understand each and every sort of things being said clearly, then we may say, okay, now there's a real enemy inside me, and I'm going to kind of use some kind of a weapon. It could be a spear, or it could be a sword or something, and I'm going to poke into him, right? But it's going to damage our own organs inside, you know? So that's why he's giggling over that, you know? So we just can't, you know, take a part of the statement, like, okay, the real enemy is inside me. Okay, now I got to put a knife into myself so that I can kill him, you know? Well, that will destroy our lungs and, you know, intestines and anything.
So that, I think when they say in Arangili Yepe, you more do sumbota. But in the rest,
So when we talk about real enemies within us, we are talking about all kinds of delusions, particularly the three poisons we talk about. There's the ignorance inside our mind, there's attachment, there is anger or hatred. So these three poisonous delusions, plus all other delusions, you know, given rise to by them, so these are our real enemies. And these enemies are much worse than the ordinary enemies we find outside. When it comes to ordinary enemy or the external enemies, you know, we have this feeling like, I cannot spend a minute with someone who is my enemy. You know, I just can't. But the irony of our life is that the real enemy that's much worse than the external enemy is all the time with us, day in and day out. During the day, you know, they are with us. At night, they are with us. Wherever we go, they are with us. You know, wherever we find ourselves, they are there with us, you know. And we have been very nice to them, you know, it's just like we are cherishing them like anything. Just come and, you know, stay inside me. That's very cozy, you know, very lovely. Just, you know, it's just like we are very welcoming to them.
Oh,
So what do you think? Do you think now we are really smart people now? So the ones who really harm us are always with us and inside us. When like someone says a slightly bad thing, you know, we just can't take it. Or even they don't have to say anything. If they give us a bad kind of eye, look, you know, what the hell you're doing. But that's enough to make us go nuts. You know, we get so mad and angry. So, I mean, there is that, like, you know, the eye, strong sense of eye, that if somebody gives us a bad, you know, look, you know, that eye gets so mad and angry, it's like, I'm right here, you know. And then
it
comes to the night. Let's talk about nice things too, right? It's about a beautiful flower, right? Either somebody presents it to us and we are going to buy one for ourselves. It's like, I really like that flower. I want that. You know, I'm going to buy it. So the, you know, eye pops up now here.
So then,
you know, when we see beautiful things, the strong sense of I pops up and we get so attached to the attractive and pretty things, you know. Or that, you know, if someone we don't like it, if he or she is succeeding in the ways we don't want it, then we really become jealous, you know. Now the strong sense of I come up and he's so jealous of that person. So that our real enemy who resides in us is ever ready to pop up, you know, ever ready to kind of jump at every different, you know, instances. So when we let our real enemy to do what he wants to do, then who is the one who pays? We are the ones. You know, when our enemy does all crazy things, we are the ones who pay the price. So the point I'm trying to make here is that all of us really need to pay attention to the real enemies who reside in us and make efforts to challenge them, to combat with them, and to counteract them. So in order to combat with the real enemies inside us, of course I already mentioned before that we cannot use any external weapons, you know, to destroy them. So let's say we cultivate love and compassion and some other positive attitudes, then they temporarily kind of overcome some of these enemies, but they really cannot get rid of the delusions from our mind. So who is the real culprit here? Why we have so many delusions, but who is the real boss delusion here? Now we look at that, there is what we call grasping at self, right? Tangzin Mariba. It is an ignorant conception of grasping at self, which is the fundamental delusion from which arises all other forms of delusion. Now that is the real culprit we need to get rid of.
No, so it's a ta, ko mebe zo el zin ta, korantan zin ta ngos ngeya ki gogo yor ta.
Now, in order to knock out this boss delusion, you know, we need to find an antidote, you know, that can really, if you will, challenge the way grasping perceives the self to exist. Okay, we need to find another state of mind that can counteract and contradict, you know, the way in which our self-grasping perceives or grasps the self to exist. So in the case of external enemies, right, I mean the enemies are come when two people don't get along well with each other. They have differences of opinions or whatever they have, you know, problem they have. When they don't agree with each other, the, you know, those differences become, you know, source of conflict, and that's how they become enemies. So in the same way, to fight with the self-grasping, we need to find another state of mind that can challenge its mode of apprehension, the way in which the grasping apprehends the self to exist, and say, you know what, this is where I can poke you, you know, this is where you went wrong.
So it's like that. So it's like, dangzita, zinta ngosungi, hinki damito vichiritiki, ta nyebu tzawade,
so what kind of antidotes, you know, is there that we should cultivate to counteract self-grasping, if we ask? It is the wisdom that perceives or realizes what we call selflessness. Because this particular wisdom can contradict the self-grasping in a way that it can challenge the way in which grasping perceives the self to exist.
Dantsi maripa dadu tsigyore, dame to bishere dadu zibati rosote, zintan ngoyen gore wa ngoyen gore wa.
Because our self-grasping grasps at the self to exist in and of itself. Yeah, that's what called self-grasping. But wisdom realizing selflessness, it perceives that such a self does not exist. Because what it really perceives is the opposite of what is being perceived by self-grasping. You know, self-grasping grasps at the self that exists in and of itself, you know, from its own side. But that particular wisdom says, you know what, there is no such thing as such a self that exists from its side, in and of itself. So that's how it challenges its modes of apprehension. Love and compassion, you know, however wonderful attitudes these are, they do not and cannot contradict the mode of apprehension of the self by the self-grasping. When we look at great compassion, karuna, you know, compassion is a state of mind that focuses on other sentient beings. In the case of great compassion, it focuses on all sentient beings, and it wishes all beings to be free from suffering. That is its aspect, subjective aspect. That's what the compassion is. In the case of great love, it again focuses on all sentient beings, but then its subjective aspect is wishing all beings to be happy. Okay. So because of these subjective aspects of love and compassion, they really cannot contradict or challenge the self-grasping, the way in which the grasping
apprehends the self to exist.
We all wish to be free from the general as well as particular sufferings of samsara or cyclical existence. So we want to be free from all the kind of general categories of suffering, samsara, and then the particular sufferings in different states of different levels of samsara.
So,
it's really very important for us to realize the suffering nature of samsara. If we really don't understand or realize what suffering is, what is its real nature, then it's really hard for us to develop sincere wish to be free from suffering. So what I really want to mention is, like, you know, when we talk about suffering in samsara, right, general suffering, the particular sufferings of the three unfortunate states of rebirth, and there are many, you know, among ourselves or other friends, right, nobody wants to listen to suffering, especially the suffering of the three unfortunate states of
rebirth.
So we don't want to hear about the sufferings in hell, suffering in the hungry ghost or the brother world, even the suffering of the animals, you know. So we should not have that kind of attitude. It's really important for us to realize what suffering is, the extent of the suffering in samsara. Only then we can really develop aversion to suffering. We want to be free from suffering. If we don't understand the nature of suffering, the extent of the suffering in samsara, then it's really hard for us to find a refuge from this suffering. We are not going to seek a refuge, you know, who can or what can help us to be free from suffering. So if we kind of you know, don't know what suffering is or all kinds of suffering, then that means that our sense of fear is really limited, right? Then it's like we are not afraid of anything, you know, because we really don't know what suffering exists. So if there is no sense of fear with regard to suffering, Then we are really not going to seek any freedom from fear. We are not going to seek refuge from fear and suffering. So we talk about practicing refuge or seeking refuge. We talk about two essential causes of refuge, don't we?
Rani kawa tangen song dungi le yichi tabe lo chise. Ta tele shabi nipa te ne achani kunju suno yeba yicheba shen. Ta tene ki yi chami bonti chami shabi bonti wasi.
The two essential causes of refuge practice are we develop the sense of fear with regard to the general and particular sufferings of samsara. Right? That means I do not want any kind of suffering in samsara. So we develop the sense of fear. We are afraid of our suffering in samsara. And then the next essential cause is we develop trust in the abilities of the three jewels to help us to get out of suffering. So those are the two essential causes of a refuge. Sense of fear with regard to suffering and trust in the abilities of the three jewels to help us. So in order to become a Buddhist, right, we must have what we call the refuge in our mind. To become a Buddhist, not just study Buddhism, right? To become a Buddhist, what we call, then we have to have, refuge in our mind.
So that,
So to become a Buddhist, we cultivate those two essential causes of refuge: sense of fear with regard to suffering. We don't want to suffer anymore. And then the trust in the abilities of the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, to help us. You know, through such understanding, we seek refuge in three ratnas. You know, relatively speaking, that if you don't understand the general suffering nature of samsara, really it's really hard for us to understand law of cause and
effect.
So when we don't understand how law of karmic action and its results function, then it's really hard for us to cultivate a sense of renunciation of samsara or aversion to the suffering in samsara.
No, no. That, ane ngijung ko samba shuta po mashe na ngijung nanda kiranjil mashe na ane thabe thabat.
So if we don't develop sincere aversion to the suffering in samsara, then it's really hard for us to have sincere wish seeking liberation from samsara or seeking nirvana. And also, if we don't realize or understand suffering experienced by other sentient beings, then there's no way for us to cultivate compassion for them. Because compassion is wishing others to be free from suffering. So without great love and great compassion, there's no way for us to cultivate or experience
bodhicitta
or the altruism. So without bodhicitta or altruism or bodhisattva's state of mind, there is no way to become an enlightened being or
Buddha.
An enlightened being, of course, it's not just enough to cultivate altruism or bodhicitta. I mean, that is an essential path to cultivate, that we need to cultivate. But really, we need to combine that with the wisdom gone beyond, for the wisdom realizing the ultimate nature of phenomena. So when we combine the altruism and the wisdom realizing emptiness together, through this, you know, path of union or the integrated path, we can find complete enlightened state. So it is by way of cultivating altruism and the wisdom realizing emptiness through this integrated path of bodhicitta and wisdom that we are able to accumulate merit and insight of wisdom. So then what happens if we fulfill the two types of accumulation of merit, positive energy, and accumulation of insight or wisdom, jnana. What really happens is, as a result of the fulfillment of the two types of accumulation, we are able to realize two enlightened bodies or kayas. The two enlightened bodies that we find as a result of two types of accumulation are the truth body or Dharmakaya and the emanation body or Nirmanakaya. When we complete the accumulation of merit or positive energy, we find a Rupakaya or enlightened form body. As a result of the fulfillment of accumulation of insight or wisdom, we find truth body or Dharmakaya. But then if we look at form body or Rupakaya, it is of two kinds. The two types of form body are Sambhogakaya, or complete enjoyment body or complete resource body, and Nirmanakaya, or the emanation body. Both these bodies, enlightened bodies, are form bodies. Now, truth body or Dharmakaya also consists of two bodies. There is what we call wisdom truth body or Jnana Dharmakaya, and then there is the natural truth body or Savabhaveka Kaya. So both these kayas or the truth bodies are truth bodies. Wisdom truth body and the natural truth body.
That's Chandra Lendene Sindhusi Sanjiku Kare Kuzuku Masuchi Padu Sandra Sandra Sindhusi Tati Ton Sakyo Dalam Nada Tema Vyartina Chikhema Tenisi Restara Duki.
So what I'm trying to do is just kind of give you a complete picture of where we began and where we can end up. Right? We began with the practice of refuge and then all the things we can do in between. And of course, we don't have time today to talk about the 10 spiritual grounds, the 5 spiritual paths, and the 10 spiritual grounds and all of that. But all those things come in between. And so finally, the final outcome or the result is a complete enlightened state or Buddhahood. So I think we will stop there and we give you an opportunity to ask questions. So please, be kind to ask your question very loudly so that I don't have to misrepresent your question. Yeah, I know.
Could Geshe-la explain how the combination, he talks about removing the obscurations to omniscience, and if he could understand the combination, you cannot remove the obscurations to omniscience without bodhicitta.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So
sure.
Is it? Could he explain the combination of the both and how of bodhicitta and the wisdom realizing emptiness? How that happens. It's clear, it's sometimes a little bit easier to understand how you can clear away the obscurations to, or clear away delusions
mm-hmm.
and illusions, but how to clear away mm-hmm. obscurations to omniscience.
To make clear delusions?
The question is about, you know, how can, we get rid of mental obscuration to omniscient state through the practice of bodhicitta and wisdom gone beyond. How do they culminate into a certain point where we can get rid of obscuration to omniscient state? Because it seems like, relatively speaking, you know, we can understand sort of like how can we get rid of obscuration to nirvana, you see, but how can we do that with obscuration to omniscient state? Now we talk about obscuration to omniscient state of the wisdom. Okay, in Tibet it's called shiddhi. This is a major obscuration, and it consists of nine different levels, or nine, you know, if you will, layers here to get rid of.
The point is that that sakyuk losing the base of bangkok.
Yes.
Ani tegi lam ali tambo tegi lam nga yoris tegi lam nga ani ani tholam ne thona ta golang ni pa ta tingi botele sapu
shegoris. So let me say that in the Mahayana Buddhism or the Mahayana vehicle, we talk about five spiritual paths, right? And within these five spiritual paths, we have the path of seeing, darshan mark, and the path of meditation. So in between these two paths, the path of seeing and the path of meditation, we present 10 spiritual grounds of bodhisattvas called dashabhumi. And as we are on these 10 grounds, we are, if you will, peeling off these layers of obscuration to omniscient wisdom. Maybe first I should kind of give you a sense of how do we differentiate between delusion or kleshya and obscuration to omniscient state. When we talk about deluded obscuration, if there's no such English word, we just make one there. What is really, the way defined it is an obscuration that primarily obstructs us from achieving nirvana or freedom from samsara. Okay? So any kind of mental obscuration that primarily prevents us from finding nirvana or freedom from samsara is called delusion. It's a delusive obscuration. Okay. Now, excuse me. Now the obscuration. Hello, Mr. Chandra. Sungir, okay. Kishan, let me say.
Hidup saya dengan hidup ditang di kegur, tak? Ditang di. Karena kegur saya na, ane saja di kompor tobat saya tak. Tobat itu tanjir kompor ini, na tanjir cuma kompor tobat lah tak? Kegur.
Whereas the second type of obscuration, it primarily obscures our mind or obstructs us from finding complete enlightened state of the omniscient state. So that's what we call shiddhi, you know, obscuration to knowledge, omniscient knowledge.
Now, shiddhi say at the point of the Kani Pangra, Sanjita was Satra Sakyo,
so as I said, there are 10 spiritual grounds of bodhisattvas, right, between the path of seeing and the path of meditation.
Uh,
So now we present 10 spiritual grounds from, you know, between the path of seeing and the path of meditation. And between these, we also posit 9 different, if you will, levels or the layers of obscuration to omniscient knowledge or the wisdom.
Yes.
So as sort of like an intersection between the path of seeing and the path of meditation, now we can talk about the first spiritual ground of Bodhisattva, right? Usually we say that the path of seeing of Mahayana is the first spiritual ground of Bodhisattva. But then we really look very subtly into the matter, at the intersection of the path of seeing and the meditation, there is the, what we call the first spiritual ground. You know, a part of it belongs to the path of seeing, a part of it belongs to the path of meditation. There's the intersection, you know. But that intersection itself is, we can say, the first spiritual ground. It is said that we need to cultivate a more powerful antidote. We say the big antidote, in order to get rid of small obscuration, in this case subtle obscuration. In order to get rid of subtle obscuration, we really need to use, you know, stronger antidote to do that. So the first is So, you know, now we're getting a little bit more like several things here. Like, in order to, you know, cultivate the path of seeing, there's something called the object of abandonment of the path of seeing. So you need to get rid of that object in order to realize the path of seeing. Okay? And so when we talk about really different levels of mental obscuration to omniscient knowledge, that as Geshe-la was you know, communicating with each other, there are like this 20 to 81, you know, divisions we talk about, and on the path of seeing is counted as one. So you get rid of one out of 81. See?
So
that means we can go all the way till midnight or 11, you know, talk about this.
That's the name of words.
So in a kind of a general sense, that in order to get rid of you know, all these different layers or the levels of obscuration to omniscient knowledge, we need to have that integrated or the combined path of bodhicitta and the wisdom realizing emptiness. In other words, the wisdom realizing emptiness alone is not enough, that it must be conjoined with altruism or bodhicitta. So that, I mean, in a technical matter, we call it the path of knowledge, lamshe. You know, because it exists in the mind of the transcendental being or the Arya, which is conjoined with a special method. So in other words, it is the wisdom realizing emptiness that exists in the mind of a transcendental being, which is conjoined with a special means or the method, which is the bodhicitta. Now I know it's getting so technical, and you know. So at least, you know, at this point of time, you know, I really must make every effort to cultivate bodhicitta and the wisdom realizing emptiness. You know, without these two things, I can't get anywhere. Yes. So what we is, we really need to get rid of the big obscurations, and what we gain in return is a small realization, so to speak. So it's our different way of thinking. We usually want to have a big result with a small effort, you know, it doesn't work that way. So get rid of the big obstacles, and outcome would be a small realization. So those of us who have you know, been through the Geshe study and program, so we know that, you know, that we need to get rid of the, you know, how to say, big obscurations, but what we attain is the small, you know, small attainment. So I think every time at the end of the teaching, or you know, we make dedications, that may we be able to cultivate bodhicitta, not yet been cultivated, enhance it in the case where we have cultivated. Same thing we do with the wisdom realizing emptiness, you know. So all those dedications are very important, you know, in this context. And here I would like to announce that I will be leaving for India soon, and this time I will be gone for quite a long time.
That 20%.
Of course, we will announce all of these things in our TDL newsletter.
That carry is the ngap ke dosere nga then the cute ngi ta.
So in my absence, Venerable Tenzin Khaja will be here, and she will be doing the Sunday teachings. So if our Venerable Geshes are here in town, so maybe sometimes we can just, you know, ask them to teach, you know, one or two class.
Yeah, that's it.
And I, you know, last Sunday I gave four-armed Ali Avalokiteshvara Genesic initiation with the purpose and intention. That is, you know, sometimes, you know, during Sundays, there's nobody here to teach you. Then what you can do is you could come here together, and you can do the meditation and recitation of Chenrezig Ali Avalokiteshvara together, and then you can, you know, accumulate as many times as you could the six syllable mantras Om Mani Padme Hum, and dedicate all that for the long life of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And then after Geshe-la returns from India and Europe, of course we will resume our regular teachings, and Geshe-la will be teaching the miscellaneous collection of Kadamba Geshe's personal advices on Sundays, and he will continue with Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand, Lamrim, on what day is this? Wednesdays.
Yes.
So And I think at the suggestion here, I think, you know, once a month, if our students could together take a one-day Mahayana precept, that would be very beneficial and wonderful. And those who have received one day Mahayana precepts first time from a guru or a lama, so now I mean, you can just take it yourself, you know, in the presence of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and all of the above. So if we all come together here, it would be nice to go through the same prayer or the ritual text together to do that. So after taking that one day Mahayana precepts, you know, then you can do meditation. You can do you know, meditation on learning, or you can just focus on Tonglen practice, the practice of you know, taking other suffering and discourses to oneself and giving happiness and discourses to others. That's called the practice of Tonglen. Is that all? Are we forgetting anything?
It's okay.
So the Monday meditation will continue. Okay, so we did not cancel any teachings, by the way. The Monday meditation will continue and Friday. So all the things happening, you know, in a week, right, in Geshe's absence will continue. The Sunday teachings will be done by Anila.
Except
Wednesday evening. So.
Okay.
Now I hope you are not confused like me, but anyway. So I can get confused because I've got the excuse in Santa Barbara, but you can't, you know, so then you will miss the
sessions.
So before we do the dedication, let me do the announcement, make an attempt to do the announcement one more time. Sunday teachings will continue with Venerable Tenzin Kazu. Monday and Friday meditations will continue. There will be no Wednesday evening teachings, okay? I hope this time I got it right. Okay, let's do the dedication. Whatever merits we have accumulated together this evening, we dedicate it for the flourishing of Dharma, the source of benefits and happiness throughout the universe. May His Holiness the Dalai Lama and all other great holy masters live long and be successful in fulfilling their visions, benefiting sentient beings. May spiritual communities throughout the world and spiritual practitioners from all traditions remain healthy, harmonious, and be successful in fulfilling their spiritual aspirations. May this and other world environments be free of all kinds of unwanted pains and problems, and may beings find peace, happiness, prosperity, and spirituality. Last but not least, we dedicate our collective marriage for all kind mother sentient beings to be free from the fears and dangers of two types of mental obscuration, and may we all reach complete enlightened state quickly.
Jesus,
So we can save our prostrations for Geshe-la's safe return, and that's all.
Oh,
no. Yes.
See you.
All
right, coming back, okay?
Yes, General.
Keep well, practice well. We need to, okay?
You keep well, too?
Yeah, keep well. Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
There you go, General.
Well, they, I don't know.